All right, let me hit record here. And hey, Jeffrey, what do you call those peanut butter cookies with the Hershey Kiss in the middle? You know what I'm talking about?
Peanut butter cookie with a... Oh, where it looked like the Hershey Kiss is sticking out of the top?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
Do those have a name?
I don't know. Peanut butter cookie Hershey Kiss. Peanut butter blossom, apparently.
It's called a peanut butter blossom?
That doesn't sound very appetizing.
Yeah, there's like, that sounds gross.
It kind of does. I can see your peanut butter blossom. Tuesday, what is this, December 30th. So one more day left. One and a half.
One day more. Another day, another destiny.
What? We're going to get sued. Great. Last day of the year. Hey, by the way.
Bring it on.
Yeah. So on taking pictures, number 140, last one of 2014.
It's kind of sad.
But then 141 is the first one of 2015. So that'll be kind of exciting. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a bittersweet moment.
Well, let's make it count.
Yes, that's right. This is On Taking Pictures, a weekly photography podcast.
Yep.
Hosted by Bill and I. My name is Jeffrey Sidoris from Faded and Blurred, and with me the fancy New York City portrait photographer, Mr. Bill Wadman.
Yeah, I like that. It was like Bill and I. You know, that was nice.
Thank you.
Yeah. How are you, Jeffrey? It's now between the Christmas and the New Year. This is sort of a dead zone for many people.
It is. I'm glad Christmas is over. Okay. That's always a very difficult time. But you know, I'm really looking forward to next year.
Good.
I've been working a lot on writing new stuff, and I've been painting a lot. It's been very productive. So I'm uncharacteristically optimistic about the coming year.
That is very uncharacteristic.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, so what are we talking about today? We got some questions in a little bit, but we got a couple things to start out with, right?
Well, you and I last week after the show, and I don't remember how this.
Yeah, I was trying to think of where it came. I mean, I guess we were talking about that Filson clothing stuff, but I thought there was more to
it
than that.
It came out of somebody wrote in. I don't remember who it was. Wrote in and said that he wore Filson clothing when he lived in Alaska.
Yeah, yeah.
And said, you know, basically you would need more than two lifetimes to wear this stuff out.
Yes.
Because it's so well made.
Jim Acevedo.
Jim Acevedo. Okay, thank you, Jim. So then you know, you and I were talking and it kind of led to this discussion about longevity and you know, when either our parents, maybe not our parents, but certainly our grandparents, you had, you know, a pair of shoes and, you know, a pair of jeans and, you know, you used things, whether it was clothing or tools or whatever, until they wore out.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and you had said, was it your grandfather bought things like the 50-year rule? Where did that come from?
Oh, yeah. Where did that come from? Shoot. Somebody else was saying.
Or it was a friend of yours that, like, that's how he approached everything.
Yeah,
was,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
This should be built to last 50 years.
Right. Everything that he bought, it had to do whatever it was supposed to do unfailingly.
Right.
So if you were buying a screwdriver, it's got to screw nails whenever you want it to. There's no question about it.
Well, you wouldn't screw nails. You'd hammer nails, but I get what you mean.
Sorry. You know what I mean. it's been a long day. But like,
about town and houseboy, Bill Wadman.
That guy wouldn't have bought, say, an electric screwdriver. He would have bought some sort of mechanical screwdriver because it has to work every time. And that's job number one. Everything else is secondary.
Absolutely. And I have very vivid memories of my grandfather having tools that his father had given him, hand tools that were still working, and you took care of them.
Yeah, I remember.
You know, you maintained your tools.
Yeah, and my father, even some power stuff, my father had like some old, remember when Craftsman used to make really good stuff, like back in the 50s and 60s, like back in the day, Craftsman used to make really good tools.
I still have my grandfather's cast aluminum Craftsman drill. Right. It's like the polished aluminum, the big gigantic thing. I still have that. Still works.
My father had a little jigsaw, like a little skill saw thing. Same kind of thing. Yeah. And it wasn't like this junky plastic thing that would break out. Like it was just, it was built like a tank. Like you could hammer screws. See what I did there?
Yeah, in with
it,
there.
You know, using it as a hammer, it was so strong.
Right,
you know,
right.
And look, I understand the world is going a certain direction. It's all about profit margin. It's all about whatever, but it's like part of what we were saying about me, say, not buying a new phone this year. It's like, I don't need to buy a new $1,000 phone. The old phone works fine. You know?
Right. So when did planned obsolescence, do you think, become the norm in photography? Because a lot of older film cameras, and I'm thinking primarily of like a Nikon F or an F2 or some of the earlier Asahi Pentaxes or
the Canon AE1s, those things, right?
Absolutely.
Or the Leicas or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, they were built to last.
Yep, and you and I and many people who listen to the show still have them, right?
Right. Yeah. So when did obsolescence become a design choice?
I think that it was after – it was earlier than digital.
Mm-hmm.
You remember when digital first started happening and you would go to a camera store? I don't know if you remember this. You go to a camera store and you look in the used thing and they would have 35 different Canon T-series film.
Okay. Yeah. Like the T-50, the T-70.
T-80 or whatever. They would have like 15, 20 of those lined up, like these plastic SLR bodies that were electronic, that did everything for you and all the rest of it. For Canon... And look, a lot of the EOS stuff is obviously built like tanks, right? This is why people use them and bring them into the jungle and stuff. But as a general rule, that's when things became plastic, sort of like the early 80s, mid 80s, you know?
Mm-hmm.
When did EOS stuff, I think 86, 85 was around that time. And
were there film Rebels or were the Rebels all digital?
I think those were all, there were film Rebels. They were originally Rebels. And that's kind of, and you see what I'm talking about though. It's sort of like the lower end digital SLRs the lower end SLRs became sort of these plasticky things that were supposed to be visually, adjacent to the high end sort of magnesium cased things of that, like the EOS One and EOS, that kind of stuff. And they started making these things, which were not at all like the older FD and early, I think it's the FD mount, the old Canon mount, or the old Nikon F mount stuff, you know. So
right.
My guess is in the 80s. However, even then, you know, as we've said many times, the problem with digital is that every time a new camera comes out, the pictures do get better. Where back in the day, you might have gotten better autofocus or faster pictures or whatever it is. But the pictures you're taking, if you're using the same glass, are not going to get better from body to body. That's not how it worked.
Right.
You know. So I think that happened, and then digital accelerated that, especially the first decade or so of digital, when things were quite literally leapfrogging each other every 18 months and growing exponentially, you know, Moore's law kind of stuff.
Right.
I think that's flattened out.
Well, yeah, it seems like we've reached a point, certainly in the consumer market, where that 16 to 24 megapixel size is the sweet spot, and now we're concentrating
it's
plenty
for 98% of the people in the world.
Right. And now we're concentrating on features again, dynamic range or faster focus or ergonomics or whatever.
Which is good news, you know. But it's one of the reasons why I tend to use the camera that I use, because I bought that 40mm Pancake, I think 2 years ago, year and a half ago, because somebody gave me a gift certificate and I used it for that, whatever, it was $150 or whatever.
Right.
But other than that, I haven't bought a lens in 6 years, 7 years. You know, I've just, because there's a certain point, I like the idea that I have my one body and I have my five or six lenses that I use and that they're fine. Unless I screw them up or drop them on concrete and they break, they're not going anywhere doing anything. They're just going to keep doing what they do. You know, and it also gets to the point where then you know your tools that much better because it's the thing you've been holding for years. You know, I bought my Mark III whenever they came out 2 years ago, 3 years ago. That camera just feels like natural to me, you know, because I'm not changing bodies every 6 months to keep up with another trend, right. You know.
Button placement, menus, things like that.
Yeah, so you don't even think about it, you know.
So is can you nowadays
imagine owning a camera for 10 years like you would have
right
50 years ago? I think we're much closer to that now than we were 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. In the sense that because things have matured so much, we're getting to the point where you don't need a new one. I mean, it's the problem Apple's having with the iPads, right?
Right.
People buy an iPad, and unless you're gaming, there's no real reason to buy another one.
Right, right. Then they've gotten, all this stuff has gotten so fast.
Yeah, it's more than fast enough for anybody, mm-hmm. you know, in many ways. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's okay. Do you think that, you know, money notwithstanding, what would make you look at your camera as not good enough? Is the next jump for you, would it have to be like medium format?
I mean, personally, for some of my more artsy work, like making giant prints, I'd love more megapixels, mm-hmm. but I can't justify it commercially. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there are things when I need more megapixels, but those things are usually when there's a budget and I can rent one, you know, so it's difficult to justify it. But I mean, but as far as what would a new body that came out have to do for me to go to it? I don't know. It's like the autofocus is great. The images, the files look great. You know, like there's very little that my camera doesn't do.
Yeah.
It's just tight and solid and does what it does. You know, the video's fine, everything, you know, there's nothing about it that's a huge deficiency, you know?
Right, right. I'm just wondering how it will, in the next, say, 3 years, five years even, how the sort of plateauing, if you will, of gear in terms of capability, what is it going to do to the conversation surrounding photography?
Well, that was even the problem. I mean, like, I used to use a 5D Mark II, then I went to a 5D Mark III. I bought the Mark, the image quality is almost very, very similar, if not identical. You know, in fact, I think my Mark II body felt faster. The viewfinder and the mirror are nicer on the Mark III, but I basically upgraded because I needed a tax write-off and my Mark II was worth as much as it could be right when mm-hmm. the Mark III came mm-hmm. out. So I sold and just jumped over to the new one. Plus mine had, you know, 100-something thousand actuations on it. It was getting older, you know, but you know, as far as how that changes conversations like ours or other shows that are very gear driven, That's a hard thing because,
right.
I mean, I think that's going to be the problem for things like that Photo Plus show that I went to.
Right.
I mean, what you, even this year you went, what did any of the big companies have to show that was revolutionary or any different than what you have now or in any way change the way you do what you do?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting.
There's not a big thing. It's like going to the car shows now. It's like, okay, so it's the new year of the new Audi, but it's just an Audi. You know,
yeah.
Like, what are you changing that makes me want to come look at it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I just thought it was interesting. The whole idea around,
I will tell you, as I get older and, you know, I'm turning 40 this weekend.
Yeah.
I want to buy less and I want to buy better.
Sure.
You know, I'd rather spend more on less that I know is going to be around for a while.
That being said, did you get the coat? We haven't talked about it.
You know, I went and looked at the coat and it's not right for me.
Okay. Nice though. Just didn't fit right. What?
It's too scratchy. You know, it's like really rough.
The wool is kind of itchy.
Yeah. And I don't like that, you know,
but I
don't know what the answer is, but I like the idea of the coat, but I didn't actually like the coat. So I'm not going to get the coat. So I'm sure there is a coat out there that is what I'm looking for. It's just a matter of finding it, you know? But yeah, I went
based on your little experience. Does the Filson sort of name and reputation, did it live up to it? Was it pretty well made?
It looked good. I will tell you that I wonder if it isn't like every other brand nowadays. You know, when you buy Gucci bag, those all used to be handmade and wood, you know what I mean? And now they're just mass produced in China or something like that, but they have the label on them, so they're charging just as much, but you're not really buying the same thing that people bought 50 years ago. You're buying essentially a knockoff that has been okayed by the parent company.
Yeah,
you know,
an official knockoff.
Yes. Yeah. You know, and that's kind of sad because people are buying it for what it used to be, not what it is. Mm-hmm. You know? Yesterday I had to go, I was going up in this building in this elevator. My mother was with me. And there was a guy there, and he had a little Leica in his hand, and he was getting in the thing. And I said, "Oh, is that the new M?" He's like, "Oh yeah, yeah, it's the new 240 or whatever the high end Leica M digital is now."
Right.
And I was like, "How do you like it?" And he says, "Oh, it's really great." He said, "You know," he's like, "Oh, you should get one if you could." And I was like, "Well, I have an M4, and I had access to an M7. I've used a lot of the film ones, and I love a digital one, but I just can't justify $8,000 for one that I'm not going to use all the time." And he said that, you know, "Oh, well, I compared it to my DF." Is that the high-end Nikon? The one that looks like an old F, right?
Right.
Right, okay.
Sort of like,
yeah. So he had one of those and a 7000 or a 700 or one of, you know, one of the older.
Okay. Probably 700. That's the full frame. 7000
Yeah, maybe he had
crop.
That one. Right.
Yeah.
And he was just like, and it was instantly obvious, you know, how much better the micro contrast was and stuff because the glass is so amazing, you know, whatever he was saying, right?
Right, right.
The usual stuff.
Whatever the brochure reads.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's looked like the problem is that if you buy something like that today, it's kind of like buying the new Apple Watch that's coming out. It's like, okay, yeah, you could spend $3,000 on the one or $10,000 with the one with the gold band or whatever it is, but it's still technology, which means it's out of date a year from now.
Right, right.
It's so
version 2 is going to kick its butt.
And that's the problem. It's like, you know, you even buy that Leica for $8,000. That's great. But 2 years from now, they come out with a new one and now it's worth $2,000. You know, it's not, you get 2 years of use out of it before it depreciates to the point where you just spent thousands of dollars to just own the camera for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's hard. I think those things are hard to, it's easier to justify, you know, I have these B&W speaker, Nautilus speakers that I have, these, like, you know, and they're really good speakers and they cost me $44,000, something like that, when I bought them 15 years ago.
Wait,
4,400, I think.
Oh, 4,400. Okay.
Something like that.
I thought you said $44,000.
No, they're $4,400. I think they were like $4,000, $5,000.
Okay.
And which is a lot of money for a pair of speakers back when I used to, you know, make good computer money. You know what I'm talking about?
Right. Yeah. Oh yeah. .com money.
Yeah. .com money. But here they are 15 years later and they still are fine. They're perfect. They sound great.
Yeah.
You know, they're not less than because a new one has just come out.
Right. Right.
And
I don't think a lot of these things that, you know, a lot of it is not less than. We try and talk ourselves into it's less than, so we can kind of justify it.
Oh, because there is a new thing. Right. Like my old camera doesn't take good pictures now because there's a camera that takes better pictures.
Yeah. 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 Suddenly 16 megapixels is crap because now there's 24. Right, well, right. For years, 16 was fine. And
I remember when I had my 20D, which was what, 8 megapixel crop sensor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I went to B&H. This was 2006, 2007, maybe. It's right before I started 365, I think. And I tried the 5D, the original 5D, 12 megapixels, which was like a revolutionary camera, full frame camera for $3,000. That was 12 megapixels, which was a lot for the time.
Sure.
And I remember taking a picture with it and being like, "Oh my God, look at the detail. Look at the, what, you know, all the stuff." Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm. But now we have phones that have more megapixels than that and, you know, right. And grab that much detail. And my camera now is twice that or whatever, you know? It's just a whole different world, right? But at the time, like you're saying, it seemed like it was amazing.
Right. And great work has been done on the previous,
of
whatever
course,
thing
always.
That you have.
Yep.
Great work has been done on that previous thing.
I just wish that these things would, I don't know that these things last quite as long. Even if you did want to keep it for 10 years, I don't know that it would still be in good shape in 10 years.
Right.
You know,
right.
I just don't think they're built quite that way. Unless you get up to like the pro bodies and that kind of stuff. Those things are built like tanks.
Who was it on the group is looking at a 1DX?
Yeah, which is, from what I hear, an amazing camera.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a 1DS3 for a while. It's a big camera. Mm-hmm. I like the portrait grip, and I like the weight of it against the thing, but it was just a little too big. And the screen was really low res compared to the 5D2, so I upgraded. Anyway, mm-hmm. It's interesting. But yeah, so I'll let you know if I find a coat. But I think that is a new there's a New Year's resolution for you, right? Like buy less stuff, but buy better stuff that'll last longer.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Make a Venn diagram too. Of desire versus longevity kind of thing.
Yeah. So, you know, it's tricky. Hey, so this weekend,
I'm a little jealous of this next one.
Yeah. Okay. So, at the National Arts Club right off of Gramercy Park, there's this big mansion called the National Arts Club. And I've shown some stuff there, and I've spoken at a thing there. They have meetings, and they have all this stuff. It's really beautiful old building with like Tiffany glass ceilings and stuff.
Wow.
And it feels very, very old school, like very old.
Like New York gentleman's club kind
yes,
of thing.
Yeah. Like you walk in there and like, yeah, everything's like leather and you know what I mean? Like it's all dark wood.
Like they would just refer to this place as the club.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can't, you know, you can't walk in with jeans on. They like won't let you in.
Right.
You know, it's like that kind of place. And so they are showing an exhibit of Saul Leiter prints, mm-hmm. which opened earlier last month, is up for a month. So
Old work.
So, uh-huh. well, yeah. So I didn't know. Well, I didn't know. So but I heard that it was there from my friend Cynthia. I was just like, hey, you know, you got to go see the thing that Saul, there's a Saul Leiter thing over there. I was like, okay, I got to go check it out. So I go over there with Conrad. We go in. It's the day after Christmas. I think it was the 26th. And we go downstairs. And, oh, yeah. Oh, I'm here to see the Saul Leiter exhibit. Which one is that? Because there's like four things going on at once. I was like, photographer, color, 50s, down the end of the hall to the right, you know.
Right.
So we go in, and it's a bunch of stuff, mostly from early color. So if you have the early color book, imagine.
That's the little like
the little
7x7
one. Yeah, whatever it is. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So imagine that one. Imagine, I don't know, 11 by 14 inch prints up on the walls. Beautiful. You know, a lot of the ones we've all seen and from the things, right? So at the beginning of the exhibit is a label, you know, your standard, you know, label of what this stuff is about. And down the bottom, I'm going to pull this up because I think that it's worth reading if I can find this little picture here.
Oh, you photographed the label.
I photographed the labels just so I could read this. So,
okay.
Blah, blah, blah. Okay. So made a highly prolific photographer period in the 40s and 50s. Well known for his color work, Leiter's distinctive imagery stems from his profound and touching response to the dynamic street life of New York. Whoever wrote this did a good job. Okay. The early color was published by these people in Germany. The little book, as he humbly spoke of it, became an overnight sensation and worldwide distribution and firmly established Leiter as an early pioneer in the history of color photography. His stuff is owned by everybody in the world, blah, blah, blah. Okay. The exhibit at the National Arts Club represents a selection of images from the book Saul Leiter Early Color. The images ranged in date from 1950 to 1962, blah, blah, blah. Okay, here we go. So down the bottom it says, I'm assuming, you know, sort of written by, Magritte Erb, director and founder of the Saul Leiter Foundation. Okay. Now, anyone who saw the documentary, what is it called?
In No Great Hurry.
In No Great Hurry, right? Which is great. If you haven't seen it and new to the show,
it's terrific.
We talked about it way back when. Look it up. It's good.
Yeah, it's terrific. It's available on DVD now. I think it's probably streaming.
So Magritte was his assistant towards the end of his life and plays a great part in this documentary where she's helping him go through boxes of negatives and boxes of whatever, right? And we also know that she was basically was hired by Greenberg Galleries who sell Saul Leiter's prints. Now, as far as I know, Saul didn't have any, I mean, there's questions of whether he had kids, but like, as far as we know, he had no, you know, kids that people talk about or whatever, like no family, whatever it is. So now Magritte now runs the Saul Leiter Foundation, which I'm assuming is, you know, trying to keep people reminding them of who Saul is and ultimately sell prints for the
sort
Greenberg
of
Gallery.
Keeping a legacy alive and getting his work out into the world.
Right,
sure.
But ultimately probably doing that since she was originally hired by the Greenberg Gallery to sell prints.
Mm-hmm.
Right, in this sort of weird circle that's kind of eating itself. And it kind of, it's what's interesting to me, now seeing her in this isn't a personal thing, because seeing her in the documentary, she really does seem like she loves the guy, you know, and is his friend and is helping him try to figure all this stuff out. But this idea of like, oh yeah, he's going to be dead soon, so we're going to send somebody in to organize all this stuff so that once he dies, we can start a foundation so that we can, you know, like, where's all that money going? You know what I mean? It's just an interesting thing because like, it no longer, what does any of this have to do with Saul anymore? Is this all just a big commercial enterprise? See what I'm saying?
I do. And I'm not necessarily saying
that that's a bad thing. I'm just, it's like, oh, it's the Saul Leiter Foundation. Well, what is that there for? You know what I mean? Like, what are they trying to do?
Well, from watching the film, from what I remember, there were, even when Saul was alive, there were quite a few uncashed checks.
Yes, yes. Yeah, he was not big on spending
money. So he was not in it for the money.
Right.
I'm sure that the gallery is
they're getting, in it for the money.
Yeah, they're getting it, you know, a nice cut. And I don't know if Ms. Erb is
right. Again, I'm not implying anything untoward. I'm just wondering, like, the idea that art, once the artist dies, art falls into this pot of commercialism.
Sure.
There's no new art being made. By Saul.
Right. So you could argue that that's when it starts to become really valuable, is when the artist dies.
Right. But that's also sort of when it becomes, to me, in my mind, in some ways, less value, in the sense that, well, the guy's not there to talk about it or being a living part of it now. Now mm-hmm. that work is just this body that just is, this body of work, interestingly
enough. Yeah, it's just a legacy.
It's just like floating down the river.
Sure. Sure.
You know, but we create these structures in order to keep it, I don't know, afloat, as it were.
Sure. Sure.
You know, and I just found it odd that, like, just looking at it, I'm like, oh, right, the Saul Leiter Foundation. Oh, wait a minute. Isn't that the girl who was helping him organize his stuff now runs the foundation? You know,
right.
Just, it was just like a weird thing. I just wondered what you thought of that.
I mean, would Saul's work or anybody's work fall into obscurity without the posthumous work of these foundations? Are there enough fans or collectors to keep the work alive? I will say that the newest book, which is called Early Black and White, the Stiedel book, is co-credited on the front with Stiedel and the Howard Greenberg Gallery.
So Greenberg is making money there too.
Right.
And it's just interesting. I wonder how that works. I guess there's some sort of division of money or, you know, something, right? Like, mm-hmm. but how that works, if I sign with a gallery, once I die, does that contract exist in perpetuity? Or if he has no, it's not like the foundation is there set up to, did Saul set up a foundation so it says all the money that comes in after I die is sitting in this pool and maybe we give it out as scholarships or something?
Right.
Like, who knows, right? Who knows
is
where
it,
the
is it like
going?
The Avedon Foundation or the Rauschenberg Foundation or something where they do outreach work and they give that money away?
Yeah.
In the form of grants.
Right, because otherwise, what is this? What are we doing?
It's all
here?
Going to Greenberg, apparently.
Yeah, which is just a weird thing because, like, you know what? Nowhere in this show does it say anything about Greenberg.
Mm.
You see what I'm saying? But mm-hmm, essentially, mm-hmm. to me, it felt like the Saul Leiter Foundation is essentially just a front for the gallery. That's what it feels like to me, and I might be wrong.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, not having experience with take.
Yeah, yeah. It was just kind of a strange thing. And I wondered how that works with other people. So we'll have to do a little research and figure it out.
Yeah, or if you're listening and you've got some sort of
inside track on the way.
Yeah, whether it's Leiter or someone else on how these foundations work, please get in touch with us, podcast@ontakingpictures.com. That's interesting. It's an interesting
right. I thought it was kind of neat. Like, oh, she goes from his assistant to the director of the foundation.
Right.
That was quick.
Right.
Like, were you just breeding her to be the next, you know, we know he's going to die and we know somebody's going to need to organize this stuff. So why don't you go help him out? And then when he dies, like, you get a big bump in pay.
I hope it's not that nefarious.
Yeah. It kind of feels that way though.
Interesting.
Maybe I'm just looking into it.
Yeah.
Hey, we should talk about our sponsor.
Yes.
Who's our sponsor today?
I don't have a song, but it's Linda. I did Linda. Oh, Linda, say, have you met Linda? Yeah, I already did that one. There's got to be a Beatles take. I'll think of a Beatles take.
Lovely Linda.
Yeah.
All right, we'll figure it out. You think about it.
Another tutorial in the wall.
Oh, nice. How about I read the ad while you're doing that?
Yeah, I mean, because talk about Yeah, talk about kickstarting the new year.
Yeah, look, Linda, you guys know about these people. They're great. So go and kickstart your new year and challenge yourself to learn something new with a free 10-day trial at lynda.com. Lynda.com is used by millions of people around the world and has over 3,000 courses on topics like web development, photography, visual design, and business,
It's a lot of courses.
It is. Imagine 3,000. That's more than 4 years of college right there. As well as some software training like Excel, WordPress, and Photoshop, which many of you are interested
heard
in.
Heard of it, sure.
All their courses are taught by experts, and new courses are added to the site every single week. Whether you want to set a new financial goal, find life-work balance, or invest in a new hobby, ask your boss for a raise, find a new job, or improve your current job skills in 2015, lynda.com has something for everybody. And if you sign up right now for your free 10-day trial, you can use the URL lynda.com/OTP.
And beware, it is Lynda, not L-I.
L-Y-N-D-A,
so
L-Y-N-D-A.
And Linda was her name-o.
Yeah. You can visit lynda.com/OTP and you'll get unlimited access to every course in lynda.com, which is pretty great.
Yeah.
You pay the money and you have access to everything. You even try this out for 10 days. You have access to everything. You can sit there for 10 days straight and do nothing but watch videos.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's say you want to make an app. They've got courses for app training.
On how to write in, what's the new app? Swift?
Swift.
Yeah, there you go. Yep. Access to new tutorials on tablets and iPhone and Android mobile devices, which is great. And access to the new courses that get added every single week. So, you know, you sign up today, tomorrow a new course comes out. You're there tomorrow. You can go check it out. So it's fantastic.
Yeah, you're ahead of the curve.
Yeah. And, you know, for photography people people at lynda.com recommend, they've got some courses. You ready for these? Foundations of Photography, Exposure, and Composition.
Right? Got it.
Basic, starting it out, right? The Practicing Photographer. That's nice, right?
That should be an ongoing series forever because you should always be practicing.
Well, how do you know it's not? And this one's good, right? Some fans are fans of The Strobist, right?
Strobist, so, sure.
Yeah, David Hobby. Traveling Photographer series with David Hobby.
He's that got guy a whole goes series. Everywhere.
He does. He loves the 60-inch soft lighter, but we'll get to that later.
That's right.
So we're gonna you know, you got to go check this stuff out. You want to learn about Photoshop. You want to learn about Lightroom. This is where to go. And so do something good for yourself in 2015. Sign up for a free 10-day trial at lynda.com by visiting lynda.com, lynda.com/OTP. So go
23,000 tutorials.
Yeah, it's crazy, right?
On photography.
Yeah. Really, that many?
That's what they're telling me. Whew.
So go ahead and challenge yourself. Learn something new in 2015 with lynda.com, lynda.com/OTP.
Yeah, look at Photoshop CC Essentials, flash and studio lighting, black and white conversion techniques.
Yeah, right there. Boom. You don't have to listen. You see, you don't have to listen to any of those, like, you know, nerdy podcasts. Just go to lynda.com and then keep listening to us for the important stuff.
Here, okay, The Practicing Photographer with Ben Long, a weekly serving of photographic insight, instruction, and inspiration from photographer, teacher, and author Ben Long. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So he just kind of goes along with you each week.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I like it.
Excellent. So we got questions this week. We got some questions. And, man, I will tell you, first of all, we don't have a billion questions, so we're going to go a little deeper into some of these. But some of these are really heavy questions.
Yes.
Like, these aren't just like Coke or Pepsi. By the way, the answer is always Coke.
Well, especially Mexican Coke.
Did you ever go
or Passover Coke?
I had a Mexican Coke today at Lasso.
Yeah.
You ever go into a restaurant and you're like, do you have Coke products or Pepsi? And they go, Pepsi. Like, they're embarrassed by it.
Yeah. 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 Sorry. Well,
you know, how much less could Pepsi be selling their stuff that you'd actually get Pepsi products in your restaurant? But whatever. Let's put that aside.
Yeah. You got to get one of those freestyle machines. Then you get people whatever they want.
God, could you imagine owning one of those in your house? I want to get rich enough so that I can have a Coca-Cola freestyle machine in my house. I once tweeted something about the Coca-Cola freestyle machine and Coke tweeted back to me saying that they're only available for commercial use.
I bet if you've got enough money,
Jay-Z's got one in his house.
That's right. Why is it we always go to Jay-Z?
Yeah. Dr. Dre has way more money. Why do we go to Jay-Z? Why isn't it Johnny Ive or?
No, because, you know, you just figure Jay-Z would have a freestyle.
Because he's got Beyonce. She's all about the freestyle.
Maybe.
Where do you want to start?
Well, look, this is right up your alley. Wayne Kochman. what constitutes a great portrait?
Who knows? You know, why don't we mix this one with Chris Connors further down? What differentiates a portrait from just a picture of a person? Does a portrait need to be a cooperative act between the photographer and subject, or can a portrait be candid? It's a similar vein. I don't know. What do you think? This is a nearly impossible question to answer.
I think a portrait can be candid.
Yes.
Because I think you can capture something unique and the essence of a person.
But per our conversation last week, does that even exist?
What?
The essence of a person capturing it. Remember we talked about...
How about the character of a person?
Okay. Okay.
How about that? Is that a better choice?
Yep.
Okay.
Sorry. Go ahead.
I mean, you know, if you look at your own body of work,
right?
What's the first photograph for you that you remember taking where you went, nailed it? That's the one. And part two of that question.
Yeah.
If that was, you know, let's say one of your 365s or one of your Drabbles or something, if you look back on it now, does the greatness of a portrait change over time?
I think that your own vision of your own work always changes over time. You know, mm-hmm. I think there are some pictures from 365 and that's what, 7 years ago now, that I thought were really good. And one of my earlier ones, in fact, if you go to my website and you go to projects, 365 portraits, there's a picture of my friend Grant in front of this Mo Pitkin sign, which is like this crazy neon sign above his head.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to go there. I'm going to go there right now. Projects.
Everyone's going
365
there.
Portraits. We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. Let me put that in the show notes.
Okay, Mo Pitkins.
You see that? Okay.
Grant Stoddard.
Yeah, okay, now that was pretty early in the year. That was January something, right? At night, kind of getting the flash along with getting the exposure of the thing right. I think he looks pretty cool in that suit. That's a really nice suit he's wearing. I always like the suits. You see how it's got the trim in the other color?
Mm-hmm.
Like it looks like it's stitched up, whatever it is. Okay. So I liked this picture. At the time I thought this picture was not like amazing, but I was like, okay, that's a good one. Like this was maybe the first good one of the series that I was happy and proud of, you know?
When you saw this photograph, would you have said that it was your best portrait at the time?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. Okay. Let's say yes. I'd have to go do a little more research.
And now,
no.
Is it even in your top 10?
No, it's not in the top 100.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, that changes. But that's the standard thing with anybody, right? I think if you look at this same page, if you go up top and like the first picture of my friend Chelsea Sexton up on the mountains above L.A., you know, I really like that picture the way your hair is. I think that's a neat picture. So there's some that are kind of cool portraits, you know. The guy with the hat on his nose, the Jose Rivera, a lot of people like that one, you know. So, you know, what makes a good portrait? I think composition has to be in there for me to be really great. There's pictures of people that are great pictures of people just because it captures some random moment that's exactly right, you know, where mm-hmm. the composition isn't great. But I think the ones that really work is where it's a great picture from a compositional point of view, and it captures an interesting moment or the person it conveys the person in a certain way. Mm-hmm. You know, further down is my friend, Trevor Neal, who's like in this, in an alleyway in London, looking all mod with a leather jacket on and this scarf.
With the scarf. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Like I like that one, you know what I mean? Cause but for me, it's also, I remember the moments that these things were taken, you know,
mm-hmm.
There's a David Robinson, the guy with looks like it's guns behind his head, like mean looking guy.
Right.
A little bit further down. He's the guy who told Elvis Costello he should change his name to Elvis.
Nice.
Yeah. He's like, this guy is old school. He started Stiff Records. So I remember sitting in that room talking to him and, you know, and, his, one of his proteges was this guy, Nigel Dick, who is a director in LA. He directed the, Baby One More Time video for, you know, whatever back in the day. And he used to work at Stiff Records as an assistant for Dave Robinson for years. And Dave Robinson used to like, you know, scream the piss out of him all the time. And he like he wrote me an email after he saw this picture. He's like, you have no idea how many times I saw that face, like, nice. Like staring back at me, you know? So, okay. So these pictures are old. Yeah. Some of them still work for me. Some of them don't work, you know?
In terms of other, not your own
yeah,
work.
Yeah. But for other people,
can you pull out a favorite portrait of all time for you?
Not off the top of my head. Yeah. I don't know. There's a lot of pictures I really like, but I don't think about it that way. I have a folder in my Dropbox that whenever I see pictures online, either that other people have taken, you know, the portraits of people that other people have taken or pictures whose lighting I really like, you know, right. or, and I always take those and I throw them in this inspiration file. That I just throw it in. Now, a lot of them, the lighting's not particularly great, but it might be that, you know, the styling is perfect or the color of the light is perfect or, oh, I like the way that the random whatever, you know what I mean? The way the guy twisted the lens and it's like, that's kind of interesting. So it's always interesting to me. There was a Abe Morello. Remember that guy? We used him as our photographer of the week once.
Yep.
Took a portrait of a Stradivarius cello once. I think we even talked about it when we shot him, or when we used him as a photographer of the week. And he stuck this cello and must have had it tied up by like string or something like that up top. So it's standing straight up on like a stool, right? Like on its pin, standing straight up. And he just unfurled a sheet of paper behind it. So it's gray around the edges, but like where the actual cello is just white. Even looking at that, I go, oh my God, that's an amazing portrait of a cello, right? Because of this cello, like what he did was he portrayed what this thing is and something like that, like something a Stradivarius cello is a person unto itself in many ways, you know? I look at that and I go, okay, that's really genius the way he did that. So I'm going to remember that and try to do that next time, you know? Look, you look at everybody's pictures. What's the one, the Peter Yang photo of, who's the actor singer guy with the really distinguished nose? Not Travis Tritt. Who's the guy with the really crazy nose? You know what I'm talking about?
No.
There's a picture that Peter Yang took, of,
oh, Lyle Lovett.
Lyle Lovett. You know that one where it's like it's a profile shot where his hat's down and it's like the light hitting him. You know, I that kind of thing, I look at it and I go, that's amazing, you know. But then there's other portraits. There's this great picture I found of Kevin Spacey out in the rain that I found once. I have no idea who shot it, you know. That picture of Putin that Stefan Louveau shot, I think is amazing, you know. But in many, a lot of times it's, you know, a photographer will get one or two shots that I'm like, okay, that's amazing. Like that makes their work, you know, their body of work.
Does there always have to be a connection between photographer and subject to make it work?
I think that a lot of times it seems like there is, but then you hear the stories behind them and the two people either hated each other or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think that it's always actually works out that way. I think we have an illusion that it's that way, but there's a lot of times when you hear, oh my God, they must've had a great session. And you're just like, they hated each other. He had 3 minutes to get the shot.
Right.
Or
right.
Whatever, you know? So I think that that's a little bit of an illusion on its own. So what makes a great portrait? Who knows?
You're still searching.
Yeah. My personal view of it comes down to, I like to see things where I'm not really, even though the light is really interesting the way it was done, I'm not noticing the light. You know what I mean? Like that I'm seeing the person, that I'm not noticing the technique. You know, it's sort of, it's my old adage, like if you can see the light, if you look at a picture and see the light, then I feel like you failed somehow. Like the light should just be part of the picture. Like it couldn't be any other way, you know?
Gotcha. Okay.
That's so fair. I mean, so there's lots of, but a lot of people would say, well, who cares about the technical stuff? Well, that's right. I do. Somebody else might not, you know, like that's what I'm into. So to wrap up, what constitutes a great portrait? Oh, hell, who knows? You know, it's nice. what you like, I guess.
Yeah.
You know,
it kind of goes back to, you know, our porn adage, you know it when you see it.
Yeah. And which is, I mean, you could say what's differentiated a portrait from just a picture of a person. It's the similar that, to the thing between, you know, what's the difference between erotic movie and a porno, you know what I mean? Like it's a, there's a fine line. It might have, both might have people having sex, but one of them feels different, you know? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's just that crazy, you know, I don't know. Next one. Let's see what you got with this one. Julian wins. What, you're not done?
No. I was just going to say some of these are not questions. They're, we also asked for ideas for the upcoming year. How would you like to see either the content or the tone of the show shift a little bit?
Yeah.
So,
Julian Winslow said something about the future of photography. Something about personal expression using photography as the medium. Do you think that? Well, actually, the answer to this is somewhat obvious, but okay. If we assume for the moment that digital and phones and all the rest of it have allowed photography as a medium to be a mode of expression for far more people than it would have been 10 or 15 years ago,
mm-hmm.
we'll allow, I think you and I both agree that that's true.
I say that that's true. Yeah, sure.
Is there any, how is that going to grow? You know, it's sort of like the, back in the 50s, everyone thought we'd have flying cars by now. But of course, we don't need flying cars because we don't need to go anywhere because we have the internet, so it comes to us. You know what I mean? Like, sort of like what the future is never how you imagine it because you're always imagining it from your biases of the present.
Sure.
And I think in some ways, the future of photography is very difficult to pinpoint.
As the tools have gotten sort of more prolific and easier to use. And, you know, I don't know that there are a vast number of better artists or photographers out there because of it. We may see that there are simply because we're a lot more connected than we were 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. Yeah. But, you know, pencil and paper have been available for a long time. And, you know, there's one, you know, Stephen King, or there's one Hemingway, or there's one Faulkner, you know, whatever.
I think there are a lot more and better photographic technicians now than there were, in the sense that that digital allows you to learn a lot faster and try things out a lot faster. But that doesn't mean that overall the ideas are getting any better, or that a photograph taken 50 years ago can't be just as powerful, you know?
No. And I think that with the sort of rise of mobile photography, I like to believe, and I have no sort of empirical evidence of this, but I like to believe that people are becoming, there's a shift. People are becoming more observant because certain groups of people that have camera phones and that use them, are becoming more observant because they're looking for interesting things to photograph. We went through that period where everybody was just photographing what they ate. And that's great. But I think you're seeing some really, really incredible mobile photography from the everyday user because they are competing with everybody they like, and they're trying to notice things. They're trying to see differently. They're trying to look at light and composition and what makes visual tension or negative space interesting. And so I am very optimistic for the future of photography.
All right, let me insert a question of my own. Mm-hmm. Where does competition in art, where's the line between it spurring creativity and then on the flip side, sort of burdening you with unattainable expectations?
Give me an example. Like, I'm not sure I understand.
You know, that you see friends' works, or as we talk about all the time, you know, you could spend all day long just looking at other people's work on the internet and never taking your own.
Sure.
Like, where's the line between, wow, I'm looking at all this stuff and this makes me want to do my own thing, versus there's so much of it out there, I don't know what to do because it seems like everything has been done in a way that is 100 times worse than everything has been done 10 years ago because there are 10 times as many pictures. You know what I mean?
I don't know. I think it still comes down to what you have to say. It's communicating who you are. It's putting your stamp on the world. Am I ever going to see the streets the way Rinzi Ruiz does, or the way that Stephen Shore does, or the way that Millie does?
Right.
No.
Right.
But I like to think that I still have a voice that is going to click with someone and is going to strike a nerve or a chord with someone, and they go, oh yeah, I really like that.
Yeah.
You know, look, yeah. I have no illusions about my dumpsters, but I don't want to stop doing them because I enjoy it.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know why.
Yeah. It's interesting. You know,
I was thinking about this a year or so ago. I mean, looking at my own attitude, let's say about my painting, has changed a great deal over the past year or two.
Okay.
And I at one point didn't want to paint because I knew I wasn't going to be in MoMA.
Okay.
And let that be the reason.
So what's the point?
What's the point? I'm not going to be, you know, hanging in museums and galleries and everything. And I think when you let go of those sort of artificial, because they are artificial, expectations, yeah, and just enjoy the work, that lets great work be done.
Yep.
Or at least good work.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. Yeah.
You know, and I don't have any illusions about painting for a living or, you know, in fact, I don't really want to. I want it to be a joy. I want it to be something that I enjoy. And if it gets to the point where it's like, oh my God, I've got to make, you know, 12 paintings so I can make rent, well, then it's time to go do something that I can do for 8 or 10 or 12 hours a day to make rent so that when I come home, I can paint for the joy and love of it again.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's so hard. All this stuff is very, very difficult.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's, the future of self-expression. I mean, I guess, look, how many people, for a lot of people and for most of the people in our group, I think it is just about personal expression, you know?
Which is nothing wrong with.
It is what you want it to be and nothing more. And maybe you share it, maybe you don't, but it's about therapy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, further down, Gary Rosenfeld wrote in saying, this may require some serious thought. Do you agree that photography or other creative endeavors can be therapeutic for depression? Why not?
Absolutely.
I think both of you and I are, where the answer is yes, absolutely. Sure.
I think it can be the cause of and the cure of depression.
Yeah, but I think that for many people, and I'll put myself in this camp, that's kind of why I do it.
Right.
Full stop. I mean, everything else goes from there. If we go back to our, you know, the thing has to work every time tool purchase stuff from the beginning, if it's not going to help me get out of the depression that I carry around, then it's very difficult for me to do it in the first place. You know?
Sure.
I need to know if that drink is going to get me high, you know, like in some crazy way,
mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why you do it. It's I don't know. Let's see. You want to take Phil's next comment?
Okay, a small portion about equipment in 2015. I don't mind that as long as it's, I mean, I look,
he was asking like things that we use that we like, is that kind
of
what you're saying?
I love the idea of gear. I love talking about it. I just don't want to talk about it as if it's going to cure everything.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, but I, you know, look, I talked about it last week. I got a new pair of headphones
and
I love them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You want to talk about them? I'll talk about them.
Yeah.
I'm not going to claim that. You know, now that I have them, I'm going to go, you know, play a David Gilmour solo.
Yeah, exactly.
But I would love to talk about recommendations for gear. And
I think part of the problem is that neither you nor I tries a ton of different stuff all the time.
Mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
know, maybe we can get the weekly report from our friends who, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got experience with
something. Well, Patrick, do a 5-minute bit at the end.
Yeah,
all the stuff he's played with the past week.
Maybe we can reach out to some more people about gear and or about software, hardware.
Yeah, we got to get some more stuff to play with.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that, Phil.
Okay, so I mean,
you?
Yeah, I mean, okay. You know, it's funny. Like I can tell you in a minute and a half everything that I use and have used for years. You know, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I have my set of Canon lenses and my Canon body that I use and I'm happy with. And I use the Alien Bees lights and I use these, you know, Fotex soft lighters. And I use a few speed lights with like a little crappy 15-inch softbox. Like that's my kit and a couple of pocket wizards, you know? So it's funny. Yeah. I mean, we can give recommendations of things we like to use and I like to use them because they're simple and everything just kind of works the way I want it to. But, you know, mm-hmm. It's tough.
So yes, Phil, we can do certainly that. Bobby Tingle.
Yeah, let me see. Is there someone in photography from whom you've learned something? Well, I think the answer is yes. And or were given an inspiration when you applied it to your artistic work? If so, what was the lesson or the inspiration? Is he asking non-artists? Because obviously you and I are very inspired by artists in other medium.
Yes, but okay. English teacher in high school.
Oh, right. Ken, we talked about that guy. Yeah.
Yeah. That guy. My friend, Mike Halverson, who was one of the 3D guys back when Gary Yost was writing 3D Studio.
Right.
Mike wrote a piece of software called Imagine, and then got into like doing those big touchscreen slot machines for casinos, and now he's doing 3D printing, and he's kind of, you know, working on bringing that industry to the forefront. But he always told me, and just do the work.
Yeah.
Don't worry about where it's going to end up. Don't worry about where it's going to hang. Don't worry about who's going to buy it. Don't worry about any of that.
You know what's interesting though about what you just said, and I agree with you. That's how I really want to think. Other people go, well, if you haven't thought about what you want to do with it, or what, like, how do you even know what you want to make? You know what I mean? That there's those people out there who do what we do, and they're always constantly thinking about where it's going to go, what it's going to do, who is going to speak to, who the audience, you know what I mean?
But you can't control any of that.
I know, but there are people who would argue that if you can't answer those questions, then you're just adrift, and that's not the way to get ahead or to be successful. You see
Maybe.
What I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. There was another fellow.
I don't want to agree with that, but it feels like a lot of people think or say that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Another fellow, Bill Moore, who I've mentioned, Father Bill Moore, right, who I've mentioned several times. In talking to him about where art goes, and we were talking about people that put up work and market not for sale, and they put it in gallery shows and it's not for sale. And his thing, and I agree with this completely, is much like the print, you know, in many ways is the final destination of a photograph, in my opinion. You know, getting the work out there is the final destination. Your job is to create the work, not to collect the work.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about your own work.
Yep.
You can collect other people's work, but that's kind of the final resting place, is to get it out into the world, you know? And I've been guilty of not doing that.
Spread
and
it's the one love.
Of the, yeah, it's one of the things that I've decided to do for 2015 is to get rid of all but one piece of everything. And if somebody wants it, you are welcome to it, because I need to make room not only in my room, on my walls, but in my head for new work.
No, you're welcome to it if you have $1,000 in cash and we'll come pick it up from Jeffrey.
Yeah, I wish. That'd be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I learn something all the time. I learn something from so many people.
You know, you've applied to your artistic
work.
Yeah,
I know. But see, the problem is that in the same way that you and I talk about this stuff all the time and have talked about it for hundreds of hours now, I think like this all the time.
Mm-hmm, sure.
The way that we talk is the way that I think. You know?
Yes.
We were at my mother wanted to go to the Rose Center, so the Hayden Planetarium, you know, where Neil deGrasse Tyson is the director or whatever. And it's the Natural History Museum here in New York. So after we did some errands yesterday, we went over to the Natural History Museum and went up and watched the new planetarium show, you know, where they talk about they were talking about matter and then dark energy and how, you know, that's all the stuff in the universe, and dark energy is like 70% of the universe and blah, 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 blah. And we got out and I said, Mom, you know, that picture of Philip Glass and this other guy. And she's like, well, I don't know which one. And I was like, the one. Said, oh yeah. Yeah. That one.
On the brown leather sofa.
Right. Yeah.
So one of Philip my favorite Glass, of your photos. Actually.
Thank you. So Philip Glass is on the right. And the guy on the left is Michael Turner, who discovered and named dark energy. And when I went in to shoot them, it was in a green room before they were giving a talk together. They were going to do like a little sit down conversation thing. And we were waiting for Philip Glass to show up because he was late. So Michael Turner and I we're sitting alone in this room for 10, 15 minutes discussing dark energy with the guy who discovered and named dark energy.
Right.
You know, and one of the sort of big benefits of my job is that I get to meet these people and get excited by what they're excited about. And I know enough about physics that I could actually have a conversation. I'm not like, what is dark energy? You know what I mean? Like, I started talking to him about it. And he was getting really kind of animated and excited, and I was getting animated and excited. And a lot of times for me, what I take away as inspiration from other people is an understanding or a sort of a mirror reflection of their inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Their energy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sure. I feed off of other people excited about something. Oh my God, I should be excited about something.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so I'm inspired all the time and have learned something all the time from people, but usually it's not specific stuff. It's more just like, oh, the way that they act or the way they look at their work, that's how I want to look at my work. You know, like the joy that they have in it, the sort of, a lot of times a very, non-judgmental, finger pointing
sure.
way of looking at their work. I look at that and say, no, that's how I have to handle myself, you know? So it's more of a respect thing for other people and gives me a better way of how I want to see my life. And so that leads to me trying new things or looking at my own work a different way or what have you.
Sure.
So anyway, it's a good question.
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you.
What do you got?
Let's see. Fernando. Yep. Carvalho da Silva.
Yeah.
Signing photos.
Yes.
Where do you sign them? Front or back?
Yep.
Pencil or pen?
Yeah.
Click date or print date? Oh, that's an interesting question. Yeah. I've never even thought about that.
He had a second part of the question, which was, yeah, do you date it the date the print was made or when you took the photo?
That's an interesting.
I tend to do print date, but I don't usually do, I don't date my photos that often unless it's for as a gift or something. So it's, you know, 6/2012 or something like that. If it was somebody's birthday or something so that you can look back on it later. Go, oh, I remember when Bill gave this to me in 2012, you know,
mm-hmm.
just as like a fun reminder. But if I sell a print to somebody, I don't date it. I personally tend to sign prints. I like signing them on the back. Unless there's a big border around the print, in which case I guess you could sign on the front, but I personally find it distracting.
Mm-hmm,
But then again, my name is not such that seeing my signature automatically gives something a certain level of,
sure,
you know, so maybe for people for whom that is true, you know, that signing it on the front's it's a privileged thing, you know? I use coated papers, both front and back, most of the time when I print, which means that I can't really print in pencil because it's sort of slimy. I have a, you probably know this company. Who's the company that makes the little pigment ink pens?
Micron?
Those? Yeah. Those. They're like tan colored.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay. So I use one of those and sign. That way I know that the signature isn't going to fade over time.
Where is it?
You have one of those?
Of course.
The only thing I don't like about them, and maybe mine's just running a little dry. Yeah,
Pigma Micron, that's one.
Yeah.
Staedtler makes one called a pigment liner that's really good.
Okay, see, this is the stuff. They're not cheap pens. They cost a few bucks.
Uni makes one just called a pin. That's a good one.
Okay.
And these are all available. Like, go to like jetpens.com. Yeah.
Or any sort of stationery store. My question for you is my thing, it might be getting dry, but sometimes when I sign too fast, it sort of runs out of ink as I'm, you know, I have to go slower or else
I get
lines. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like it's drying out.
That's what means it's drying out. Okay. So maybe I just need a new one. I've had it for years. I'm terrible with that kind of stuff. So anyway, I tend to like the back. I tend to like pen and I tend not to date. So. How do you feel about that?
Do you do numbered editions?
Sometimes I do. Most of the time I don't.
Yeah.
What? How do you feel about, do you sign your paintings on the front?
Back.
Back. See, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't need the ego boost.
Yeah. It doesn't, it's an extraneous sort of element or object that I think detracts from the meaning of the piece, or, yep, or the line or form or color of the piece. But that's just my opinion.
Sometimes people ask me to sign it on the front.
Mm-hmm.
I also have a little stamp that says Bill Wadman original, and I use pigment ink stamp, and I put that on the back too. Just so that, you know, in the future, God forbid, I end up becoming something, you could at least tell the difference, you know, between ones I actually made and ones I didn't.
I don't think the print you sent me has that on the back. Is it a knockoff? Did you send me a knockoff?
I didn't. I'd be surprised if I didn't.
I'm kidding.
The only annoying thing about the pigment inks is that you have to wait. You have to let them dry.
Yes.
Like they'll smudge if you're not careful. So sometimes you either have to blow on it for a while, leave it out for a while, or take a hairdryer to it before you roll it up or something, so you can't be crazy. All right. So Lauren Shin has some ideas for new stuff in the new year. What do you got here?
Oh, and Lauren's a new member of the group.
Oh, she is.
So
good.
Yeah.
Welcome.
So that's cool. Welcome, Lauren. Okay. So she's talking about power dynamics in photography, exploration of the philosophy and psychology of photography and art, the relationship between photography and art and entrepreneurship. Oh, that's a good one.
Yep.
She'd like to hear some reporting on recent art news. I would too, actually. I would love to hear what's going on and talk about what's going on in the areas of the country.
Oh, is that what you're thinking? You think that's what she's saying?
I don't know. Is that how did you interpret it? Did I not interpret that right?
I looked at that and go, is that kind of what we do when we do our like news stories? But maybe we're too, I mean, we tend to be photo centric, but that's sort of part of the show.
Maybe expand a little bit.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Yeah. I'm fine with all of these things. I thought the power dynamic stuff where she was talking about, I think this is the one she was talking about where she was saying between, say, somebody hiring you or an ad person, or, you know, like that between the photographer and the subject, between a photographer and a client, what if the client's not the subject?
Right.
What if, you know, yeah, those are interesting topics. So we should talk about those. Yeah.
It seems like, and I don't know this for sure, but there's a part in, what's the Avedon flick, Darkness and Light.
Mm-hmm.
Light and Darkness? Darkness and Light?
Something like that.
Something like that. Anyway, where he's sitting down talking to, the now adult girl that appeared on the cover of In the American West.
Okay, yep.
With the freckles, you know, and the overalls. And she's talking to him about how she was, you know, she was mortified because she saw this picture when she was 18 and prom queen and all of this. And this was this photo of her when she was 12 and had freckles and felt exposed and felt ugly and all of this kind of stuff. And Avedon is talking to her about, you know, I have the power as the photographer to, you're a part of it to be sure, but I choose, you know, whether to use this picture or that picture, whether to light it from this direction or that direction. And it got me thinking when I was reading this question or her email about it, I think that feels like it has changed because especially in like advertising photography, it's not just Avedon and a subject, it's photography by committee.
Yes. Especially if you're doing a thing where there's monitors on set and, you know, yeah, absolutely.
So that power dynamic has changed and you've sort of sloughed off whether intentionally or inadvertently, you've sort of sloughed off some of the power to the client, the creative director, the art director, the
power
stylist.
Has been diluted. And not necessarily in a way that I think makes for better product.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in a way that in some ways, I don't know. What's the word I'm looking for? It makes the artist feel a little impotent, right? You know, it's just like, okay, if I have no power, then why am I even here?
Right.
You know, if you're not hiring me for the fact that I have good judgment in these senses, then this could be shot by anybody, you know?
Well, and that's, we've talked about that. It comes down to, you feel like you've been hired for what you have done, not what you can do.
Yeah. 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 But even more so, you get hired as, you know, a hired gun as opposed to an assassin. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't know that it always, that, not that it makes me sad, but it just sort of makes me think, you know what, like, give people a little benefit of the doubt. Let them make something, you know. Sure. I remember when a few times when I've sent in ideas for things and people have sent me back, they're like, yeah, it doesn't quite work, but I'm not going to tell you what to do. Try something else, or, you know, change it. It's a little this, but, you know, they're not saying it's a little this, make the this big. Back in the design days, it's fun, it's great, but make the logo bigger and do this and do that and do the other thing. How about you tell me what you...
Wasn't that the default one? Can we make the logo bigger?
Right, but like figure out a way that you can make... Tell me that it's not quite right, but give me a chance to come up with a way to fix it. Because maybe I'll come up with a way to fix it that's better than what you originally imagined. You know, like give me feedback, but don't tell me what to do.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And I think that that's something that we'd be better off if we could do a little bit more of that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know,
do you see that coming back around? I mean, you're much closer to it than I am.
I hope so. The problem is that a lot more money is on the line now, a lot of times, mm-hmm. you know, and things need to be turned around a lot faster, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So, I don't know, maybe that ship has sailed. I hope not, but you know, maybe it has, I don't know. What do we got? Where's the next one here?
Is it the last Gary one about?
Oh, we didn't get Matheson here. Let's imagine someone, Christopher Matheson writes in and says, let's imagine I need some creative inspiration for my work. Who is the one creative type you would recommend that I study?
David Carson.
No, seriously, would you go with like a graphic designer? Who would you look for inspiration? I tend towards painters. I go to MoMA or the Met and I look at paintings.
I'm really, because I wrote this thing for Faded and Blurred recently on the story about Rauschenberg erasing the de Kooning.
Yeah.
So I found myself going back through de Kooning and man, he's good.
I really like de Kooning. He to me is a little bit like Picasso in the sense that while he does have a style, not all of his stuff looks the same.
Yeah. I've decided that I want to get the Elderfield retrospective book.
Okay.
Because I love Rauschenberg, and Rauschenberg is probably overall my favorite of the sort of modern New York artists of that time.
Yep.
But man, de Kooning's line work and his shape and his sort of bold use of color and form.
It's the color that gets me.
Yeah. I mean, he just, the guy was just, you know, the cat's meow.
I feel like he doesn't get respect he deserves.
Yeah, he's in kind of a weird, it's almost like he's in the same company of some of these people, but almost like second tier, like he's second string.
Yeah, and I don't know
why.
You know,
and I don't get that.
Yeah, I completely agree.
You know, I feel the same way kind of about him as I do about somebody like you know, like Boucher or Fragonard from the 18th century, where, you know, they were such incredible draftsmen and such incredible figurists that I don't know.
As I get older, I look at hierarchies of artists, sort of, you know, we in this world see Picasso at a certain level. We see de Kooning at a certain level. We see, you know, whoever at a certain level, Van Gogh at a certain level. I'm beginning to see those sort of structures of objective quality as being much more about rolling dice about how the world sees them. And that is much a mirror on society as it is an objective question of whether the art is good, you know?
Hmm. Okay.
It's sort of a right place, right time with the right message that meshes with what the edges of the future are, you know what I mean? Sort of the zeitgeist and all this kind of stuff in a way that much less so than I used to be, in that the people who are on top are obviously good because they wouldn't have gotten anywhere near the top, but that the people who are really on top doesn't necessarily mean they're better than the ones right below or the right below that. It's just sort of, they were in the right place at the right time or knew the right people or knew, you know what I mean? That it's all much more fluid than I imagined it being when I was younger. You know, you imagine it being very much sort of like, oh, you are a valedictorian because you have the highest grade point average.
Right.
But
right.
Art isn't like that. And music isn't like that. And writing isn't like that. because there's no grade point average. There's no test key to compare it against.
Right.
Right. So in that same way, when I look at other artists' work, it's like I tend to look at painting because I try to look for ideas that would make sense in photography, and at least it's then a visual medium that's two dimensional. But they have so much more freedom in painting than we have in photography in some ways.
If I were shooting the type of things that Christopher shoots, and I mean, I love Christopher's work. I have for a while now, and I would look at Hopper.
Or go even further and read sort of beat poetry about people walking down the street.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Sort of like, oh, you know, what's going on out there? Where's that guy going? You know, that sort of the writing stuff, because a lot of it becomes about the mystery of what's in the frame, you know, or not in the frame. It's tough.
Or you could go the other direction. Christopher lives in Tokyo. You could go, you know, read William Gibson. In fact, I'm going to recommend that to you, Matheson. Go read The Peripheral, Gibson's newest book. It's
good.
It's terrific.
I didn't know that. I've checked it out.
It's terrific.
Okay, we got a couple from Gary Rosenfeld. What do you got?
Well, you got the center one.
Oh, we already did the center.
You already did.
Oh, the top one's for me.
Yeah, for Bill. When you get hired for a portrait job, what steps do you take to prepare? And at what point do you say, I'm ready? Please show your work when answering. All right, so you need to give a page number.
Well, what I do is I make sure my batteries are charged, and I delete my card, and then I say I'm ready. Actually, sometimes it is that simple.
So it depends on the subject?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times, I mean, most of the stuff that I do for magazine stuff, they're all like editorial portraits, right? So I'm walking into somebody else's world. I have no idea what I'm getting into, and I got to make something that looks like something, you know, in which case it's not like I can say, oh, I know what I'm going to do with them. I'm going to use these three lights and this background. And you know what I mean? Like I don't.
So I would imagine your prep is different on location versus in your own home.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm in my own home or in some studio space, then it's a blank slate where stuff where you're shooting at somebody's office or somebody's house or somebody's whatever or on the street. I mean, you're working with the environment you have and trying to get the subject to interact with you in some ways so that you get something more out of them than them just looking at the camera, hopefully, you know?
Right.
And then also have the light and everything else work nice. So I try to keep the technical side of it a little bit more simple because I want to then not have to worry about that stuff and just worry about the subject. Some people are different. Some people are all like, you know, I'm going to get the technical stuff perfect. And the subject is just like a still life that I stick in there, you know, and then hopefully I can make that work. I do. I mean, as I said before, a lot of times, depending on the person, I'll do research or at least look the person up and know a few facts about them. So that if conversation gets boring, I can say, oh, you went to school in Chicago. Did you, you know, what year was that? You know, so then you can go, oh, I've been to Chicago, you know, at least, oh, there's this restaurant, you know, at least then you start getting them thinking about stuff that they're not thinking about.
Sure.
And you sound like you're not just some guy who came in to take their picture. You've like, oh, they know something about what I do or, you know.
Do you approach people, you know, photographing people, you know, differently? Like for example, let's take Seth and either Neil or Baratunde. Do you approach people that you are personally familiar with?
Like friends.
Yeah. Different than generally, somebody that you don't know.
Only in so much as the small talk has shifted. Cause if you've known somebody for a little while, you tend to, you know, you're having a deeper conversation perhaps. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Where like, even like when I went up and shot Seth, I mean, I spent an hour with the guy just chatting and taking pictures and he was very nice and very helpful, but I wasn't going to, you know, talk to him about, you know, the next apartment I buy. You know, or whatever.
Right.
You know?
I mean, there's a different level of rapport versus somebody like Neil, who you've known for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but that's okay, right? You know what I mean? Like, that's the way it's supposed to be in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, as far as the picture taking part of it, no, I do not see them differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is at a certain point, like you said about your, who's the guy who does the painting, your friend, the father?
Oh, Father Bill Moore.
You know, it's like, at a certain point, I just have to do what I do, you know?
Right.
And just stop thinking about it and do it, you know, and hopefully you're doing it in such a way that either you get some joy or the results are good or you get better at what you're doing. But, you know, you have to jump in the water and just swim.
Sure.
And there's going to be would you ever see people, it's like you go to a gym sometimes and you see people on a treadmill and you see them running or whatever. And you go, how does that person run like that? Either in an impressive way or in a, wow, they're really gawky way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
you think, you know what? At a certain point, your body is built a certain way. You're going to run or walk a certain way. You know, somebody walks like a little, like with their feet, a little duck footed outwards, you know what I mean? And then there's some people who run and they look like they're going to step on their toes every step they take, you know, so in the same way, I think creatively, you know, I take pictures the way I take pictures because I am me, not because I'm laying out every single step from A to B or A to Z of how to do that. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that, and I've kind of come to terms with that where it's like, I can't try to be somebody I'm not, you know, I can only be me. And if I can be the best version of me, well, that's the best I can do. You know, what's the last one? I mentioned this in a previous post. When watching Gregory Cruzan's documentary, I found I had physical reactions to his work, not just emotional, i.e. knots in my stomach. Have either of you ever had that from things you've seen in the past? Can you share with us what you saw and how it affected you? What do you think?
What were the knots from?
From angst, from fear,
from the sense of kind of loss and yeah. emptiness that are often themes in Gregory's work.
Yeah. You've had this. I mean, you obviously have it happen in movies and stuff. You cry or you know. Get
I do.
Excited.
I yeah. do.
You're a softie.
I do.
Yeah. You cry in the steps of the Capitol.
I did.
Yeah,
I did. Yeah, that hit me really hard for some reason. Yeah, I mean, I think that speaks to two things. I think it speaks to the power of the work, whatever that work is, and I think it speaks to your willingness to be affected by the work.
Yeah.
Because if you're not willing to be affected by the work, whatever that work is, whether it's a sunset or a painting or a film or a piece of music, then it doesn't matter how good, in quotes, that work is. It's not going to affect you.
Sure.
You know, you've got to be open to it. And I try to approach a lot of, you know, as much as I can and experience it, whether it's, you know, film or a piece of music.
Yeah.
I try to let myself be affected by what that person or persons were trying to do with that piece of work.
Yeah. I mean, I get a certain sense of centeredness when I see a photograph that hits me the right way, whether mm-hmm. that's compositionally or structurally or subject matter, you know, something that feels a certain way to me that tends to be more painterly looking things kind of make me feel very centered, which is kind of why I go in that direction with my own work. But beyond visual art, the thing that really gets me a lot of times, I'll listen to music and a lot of music will give me goosebumps at times that are in a way that visual arts don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know,
mm-hmm.
maybe I'm in the wrong business, but like they're on a different level, you know? I was even listening. We watched that Into the Woods this weekend, and then for Conrad's podcast, they were comparing it to Les Mis, the 2012 version.
Sure.
You know, and Anne Hathaway's version of I Dreamed a Dream was really good in the Les Mis, like really good.
Ugh.
Where,
ugh.
Well, yeah. Well, here's the thing, right? Like I'm not a Hatha hater, as they say.
Is that what they call them?
People who don't like Anne Hathaway.
Ugh.
Hatha haters. Yeah. Like, I mean, I know, like,
I don't hate her. I just don't think she deserved all of the
kudos
she got.
Well, yeah. Did you see the movie?
Yes.
Okay. I thought her singing was very, it wasn't like the best thing I've ever seen, but we were watching it in order to compare it to the other one. And so I wasn't really watching it. It was like kind of on as I was like looking at something else, and her singing that song, it stopped me for a minute and I had to watch the screen. You know what I mean? In a way. So there's a certain attention thing that also happens where a piece of work, whether it's someone's writing or music or whatever it is, will not just ask for your attention, but demand your attention.
Sure.
Where your eyes go straight to it on a wall. There's 15 pictures on the wall, but one or two of them are the ones you kind of go straight towards. Why is that? Well, who knows? I mean, you can't just, you know, for any myriad of reasons. So I think that the physical reactions to the work, absolutely. But it's more of, you ever get the like tingling up your spine from stuff?
When work, yeah, when I see some work,
when
absolutely.
You, even when you see it, you get that feeling.
It happened in DC on a number of occasions, walking through like the National Gallery and seeing, again, some of this work that you read about, you see in books, and now you're standing there in front of it.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God.
When we were at the Uffizi last year and I spent like 15 minutes standing in front of Birth of Venus. And I was like,
yeah,
that's the Birth of Venus. Like that's one of the top 10 most famous paintings of all time. And here I am just standing in front of it. Like this is really, that's the actual object.
Yeah.
Like, that's weird.
I mean, it is weird. I sobbed like a schoolgirl at David.
Right. See, but I get a certain giddiness, but I don't get an emotional thing from visual stuff like that. Like I'll stand there in front of David and be like, that is so cool. You know, I'll get like that.
It wrecked me.
Yeah. See, so, I mean, I guess you and I get different reactions.
Yeah. But even seeing, you know, seeing sort of the chapel that, you know, Da Vinci's family, their personal chapel, seeing that. And then I start thinking about, you know, his sort of, you know, feelings about why he was creating and what he was creating. And that kind of sends me off on a tangent and I get all wrapped up in that. And then, you know, so I don't know.
Again, you get wrapped up in the story.
I do.
All right. So those are good questions.
Thank you, everyone.
How did people do last week?
Come on. It's family.
Yeah.
So some absolutely
Could they be?
Yeah. Terrific pictures of family, of children and grandchildren and grandparents and friends. And this has been one of my favorite assignments. I really like seeing
a lot of people, came in with the pets.
Yep. A lot of pets, a lot of really, really great work though.
Dwayne Christensen has a very large family of people.
That's a big, yeah. And I love Jason's shot right below that. Who is that? Is that your father, Jason?
Yeah, that's good stuff.
That's a. So a lot of really great. So Bobby, good stuff. You know, really fun.
Yeah. Is that Derek and his father? Cause that's pretty great if they both have big beards like that.
Hold on. I probably scrolled right past him.
Black and white. He's in the foreground.
Yeah.
That's where, I like Jeff Preston. Newest member of his family is an enlarger for his dark room. That's genius.
Okay. Did you read the comment? Look down below it. Blah, blah, blah. Looks like you got a good deal. Jeff says it was all free. I just had to carry it out of the basement. Score.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it comes down to nowadays a lot of times.
I mean, what it looks like you've got, is that a Yashica mat? Is that a 124G in there?
It could be, yeah.
Center, little twin lens thing?
Yeah.
You've got a rotating lens platform. You've got 35, 120, and looks like 4x5.
This is a color enlarger too, isn't
it? Lens carriers, yeah. You've got a color head there. I mean, score.
Way to go, Jeff.
So yeah, good stuff. Really good stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So that was Christmas. Now we got New Year's. What are you giving them?
You came up with this. I like this
one.
Yeah. Oh, and I will say, if you haven't seen it, go check out, Gary Yost's video footage that he shot 240 frames per second
out of the phone
with the iPhone 6. This really cool, black and white clip. Go check that out. It's in the group.
Yeah. I saw that.
Gary's always doing the cool stuff.
Yeah. He's doing the cool stuff with the video.
All right. So, my favorite family picture, just one.
Yeah.
Eric Zia with, I'm assuming, his boy with the hat, with the Christmas tree on it, the brown paper bag.
Yeah.
So cute. Really cute.
So this week we're going to do renewal. Hashtag renewal.
Renewal. That's a tough one.
It's a tough one.
Renewal.
Yeah. And yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. If it's you renewing your gym membership, that's good too.
What are you trying to say?
You know, it's really frustrating. Now is coming down to the time when all the resolutioners go to the gym. Like, I go to the gym 5 days a week.
I'm gonna renew my commitment to you, Bill.
Aw, that's cute. Are we gonna say some vows?
That's right.
All the people are coming in who are like, I'm gonna go to the gym all the time, but I go to the gym all the time. So January ends up being twice as many people at the gym, so you can't get on machines and stuff.
They start out the year, but then by March it's empty again.
Yeah, I just gotta wait them out.
Yeah.
You know.
Wait it out, man.
So renewal, hashtag renewal. I think it'll be fun.
Renewal. Yes. That's a good one. Okay. Photographer of the week. This comes from Carl Beal.
Yep.
And I like this, Carl. This is good stuff. Matt Black is his name.
M-A-T-T-E Black.
Oh, wouldn't that be awesome?
I would change my name to M-A-T-T-E Black. I would totally change my name.
That would be the best, right?
Yeah.
Or if your middle name was like Edward or something, then use the E.
Yeah, oh my God. Matt E. Black. Jeez.
Yeah. Genius. Good call. So this stuff is really good. Documentarian, photojournalist, grainy black and white. A lot of stuff. Is it all California? No. A lot of stuff in California. He's in Mexico. He's in, this one called The Dispossession. A woman at her shanty town in Fresno. That's
the one with you in it.
Yeah, that's right. Come on, I'm going for a dip. What do you want? Guy can't go in the river in a hot day.
Image 5, disposition people. Check it out.
Cloud Stories, really good. Joaquin's Town. I mean, just this is really nice stuff. In fact, the Joaquin's Town, the cover shot there, it's an empty field after a flood. I love that. I like the way that this is presented too, the site where
it's a really details. Crazy.
What do you got?
I just like mud flats when they crack like that. They freak me out a little bit. Creeps me out.
The Black Okies.
I always feel like they go straight down into hell.
They cracks. Might. Yeah. You don't know.
The Black Okies, some crazy stuff in there.
That's some
where's
amazing.
Tevaston, California?
I don't know. But this is getting into sort of the, Walker Evans kind of territory.
It looks like Walker Evans, even though it's, you know. You know where this is?
Where?
This is like right outside of Sequoia National. It's right outside of Sequoia National Park. It's north of Bakersfield.
Ah, okay. Okay.
McFarland, Delano, Visalia?
Visalia?
Yeah, somewhere in between there and Bakersfield, that's where it is. So, in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, like up a state
the
road.
Third route, this is an amazing set of photographs. People digging for water in a riverbed.
Yeah.
Families.
It's amazing, this level of poverty in America in this day and age, you know? It always amazes me. Because I live in a place where obviously there's lots of poverty. I live in New York City. Mm-hmm. But not quite like this, where it looks like it's out of time. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay. This is in his backyard. Matt Black is a photographer. I'm just going to read you his about page. Matt Black is a photographer from California's Central Valley. His work has explored themes of migration, farming, poverty, and the environment in his native rural California and in southern Mexico. Recent photo essays have been published in The New Yorker, Mother Jones, and Vice magazines. He's a contributor to the Everyday USA Photographers Collective and was named Time Magazine's Instagram Photographer of the Year for 2014. Oh, well, I will go follow him right now.
It's very Robert Franke as well, too.
Yeah, it's got that kind of Americans feel to it, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, really good stuff. So thank you, Carl. We'll put a link in the show notes.
Matt Black.
Bitter Harvest.
Not this to be confused with Glossy Black.
That's right, his cousin.
If I had a kid and I was this guy, I would totally call the kid Glossy.
Yeah.
He's got a good look himself. You see this picture of him on the blog page?
Yeah.
He's got a, he's like a rugged guy. So basically he's taking pictures in a very, in a area of the state where he lives. So he's probably just driving around the area. Great stuff. Matt
now
Black.
This is, I mean, it makes sense because this is our comment about Walker Evans or even Dorothea Lange. You know, this was where some of those migrant, you know, farms were, this area of California.
Yep. Absolutely. Crazy.
Yeah. I like his work. Matt Black. Matt, yeah, if you're listening to the show, you're terrific.
Yeah.
Call me.
Yeah. Are you doing the little thing with your hand?
I am.
All right. So if people want to get a hold of us before the end of the year, how do they do that?
Well, even if you miss it, you can get a hold of us.
They can still get a hold of us in the end of the year? Okay.
podcast@ontakingpictures.com.
Yep.
Bill tweets at Bill Wadman.
Yep.
And I'm at Jeffrey Sidoris.
Yep.
And you guys, thank you for another really, really great year. We couldn't or wouldn't do this show without you. And I'm, like I said, I'm really optimistic about 2015. I'm really looking forward to continuing and growing the show and just doing more creative work myself. I want to get back in the stream, you know?
Back in the high life again.
That's a great tune.
It is a good tune.
Although my favorite Steve Winwood tune.
Valerie?
No. No. Come on. What do you think? You can't guess?
Is it, what the hell is the song that he did when he was like 16 years old?
Low Spark of High Heeled Boys.
Oh, a different one. Okay.
Yeah. That's my favorite song.
All right. I will go check it out.
But that was really technically Traffic, but yeah. Still. Yeah. All right. Thank you guys.
Yeah,
thanks
we'll
for
see you
listening.
Next year.
Yeah. Have a great new year. Be safe, whatever you're doing. And we'll see you in 2015.
Woo!
Woo!
This way, say what you wanna say, though I know your words will lay me out, so I can hear.